Why are mysterious disappearances so fascinating to us as a culture? What makes us continue talking about them after decades have passed? Unfortunately, most people who disappear do so without a trace. It's incidents like these that make me wonder if there's something much less human going on. I feel like we all have an innate tendency to wonder about the dark and macabre things that cannot be solved by science, and sometimes we avoid them because our brains can't come up with a logical explanation. They keep us guessing. Even with our technological advancements and scientific accomplishments, there are still some things in our world that may never be explainable. We are fascinated by mystery because usually things have answers and solutions, but not these. These leave us with questions. These mysteries leave us craving answers because the fear of the unknown is a nightmare. We simply crave answers to make the world seem like a less terrifying and infinitely unknown place. In the case of Stephen Kubacki, when he vanished in the Michigan Triangle, investigators sought out the most mundane reason for his disappearance. Even though none of the pieces added up, they opened and shut the case without a second thought. Nothing within their investigation should have led to this as a logical conclusion. But it's exactly as I stated before. The known is much more comfortable than the actual reality of some situations. For Stephen, the fact was that he disappeared without a trace. He did not fall through the ice, drown, or run away. Within the blink of an eye, he was gone. Stephen's community was terrified since no one could provide them with an explanation that answered all of their questions. That alone scared his community so immensely that they accepted a false reality and simply stopped looking for him. But these conclusions would soon be proven wrong. What happened to him? Was there a more sinister force at play? These are all things that Pamela and I want to find out. I would be surprised if there weren't similar cases to Stephen's around the world. Can we find a connection between them, or is there no human explanation? Last season, we investigated Anatoly Moskvin, and as strange as his story was, nothing can compare to some of the leads we have investigated in Stephen's disappearance. Nothing can compare to the unknown. Hey guys, welcome back to a brand new season of the Haunted Detective Podcast. I'm your favorite host, your local department store Pam, only at Macy's, and with me...
I'm your favorite skeptic and co-host, not Pamela Hamza. I don't know where you got that last name from, but that is not my name.
The lore is that when I first put Pamela in my phone, I put her last name as Hamza because I was positive that I saw that. It was either that or it popped up as maybe Pamela Hamza. So it was one of those two things.
Did you know another Pamela at one point?
No.
Hmm.
And then her email saved in my phone, in my contacts, is PamelaHamza@sbcglobal.net. And I'm like, am I the wrong timeline? Did I traverse?
It's a very random name. But anyway, yeah.
For those of you who don't like dim-witted side banter. Traversing timelines is actually relevant to this season. This season, we're going to be talking about Stephen Kubacki, who mysteriously disappeared and reappeared. And I'm giving you no more details than that because you need to listen to the episode. And don't forget, if you're not subscribed to Patreon and you don't want to listen to all the ads, turn this off, go to Patreon, subscribe, Haunted Detective. It's in the description of this episode. It's not hard to find. And go there. Because we love you and we don't want you to have to listen to ads. We love you and we don't want you to have to listen to ads.
I mean, if you have abs, that's great for you. Really good for you. But if you don't want ads, then like maybe go subscribe to the Patreon. But yeah.
We're going to be getting into some just absolutely crazy this season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we are going to open the case file. Where is it, by the way? I couldn't find it when we entered our real office. That's very real today.
Yeah, super real. I think I might have...
Is it with the parrot again?
Parrot? Did you get a parrot? Greg.
Yes, his name is Greg.
Why did you get a parrot?
He lives in the office. Because he lives in the office. Who else is going to be the security system?
Like an actual security system, maybe?
That's boring.
Okay. We're going to have to talk about that later. So,
Whoa, do you hear that? That must be Greg.
Just get the damn case file.
Oh my God, you have to get it from the parrot.
You get it from the parrot.
No, you get it.
Greg. Please. Just give me the fucking case file. Thank you. Love you. I love you. Yes, I love you too.
He's screaming at you. You just have to take it. Just rip it from his...
No, Greg, give it to me. No, drop it. Drop it. Drop it. Ow! Fuck. He bit me.
Yeah, he does that. I trained him to do that.
Why did you do that?
Because he protects the case.
That really hurt.
He protects the case file.
That actually really hurt. I can... You know what? I'm going to take a step back. I need a break. And then I will come back and I will record.
We paused this episode due to technical difficulties.
Okay.
That was... a full 12 hours. I've been sitting here for 12 hours.
Yeah, I needed a break.
Okay. Are we ready? Do you have the case file?
Yes, I have the case file. I'm ready to go.
Okay. Let's open the case file. Michigan is notoriously cold in the winter, especially in the month of February. For 23-year-old college student Stephen Kubacki, he didn't mind the brisk air. He was an adventurer, an experienced mountaineer who was used to facing undesirable elements head-on. But in 1978, everything would change for Stephen and his family. On a solo cross-country skiing trip, he vanished, leaving behind no sensical clues to where he could have gone, thus beginning the disappearance of Stephen Kubacki.
Are you intrigued?
I am.
Sick. Something bad happened on February 21st, 1978. That's what two snowmobile riders assumed when they stumbled upon abandoned ski gear while out riding in Saugatuck, Michigan. An area with difficult terrain to navigate and rough weather. They immediately contacted the authorities because the scene before them was not only concerning, but it didn't make sense. Stephen Kubacki was an experienced outdoorsman and mountaineer. It wasn't unlike him to use his free time to set off on an adventure. He was used to braving cold weather, mountainous terrain, and other undesirable conditions. So when he ventured out for a day-long solo cross-country skiing trip, no one thought anything of it. No one expected him to simply vanish. But once an air and land search was conducted, it became obvious that the abandoned gear belonged to him. How is it that an experienced man such as Stephen would disappear and leave behind his skis and backpack? The only other clue as to where he could have gone was a 200-yard path of footprints that, when authorities followed it, led past the edge of the lake and stopped without warning. The ice was unbroken and unaffected. Yet the police automatically chalked it up to a case of drowning. They believe that Stephen had fallen through the ice and drowned. Is it just me, or does that make absolutely no sense?
I mean, it would have had to have been a perfect storm for him to be able to walk up, drown, and then the ice to freeze over exponentially fast.
No, it takes like several...
No, I mean, that's what I mean, is it would have had to have been like a perfect instance in the sense of like...
No, even in a... perfect instance, ice doesn't just freeze back to make it look untouched. That takes days.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. Like, it would literally have to be something that's not real. Like, it would just have to be so incredibly just incredible that it just couldn't happen. But it makes me wonder why they came to that conclusion fairly quickly.
Yeah, because for one, the ice wasn't touched and Stephen wasn't missing long enough for someone to report it, let alone for the area in which he supposedly fell to freeze back over. And on top of that, what would have prompted Stephen to wander out onto the presumably treacherous ice in the first place? If it was breakable, like police are claiming, He was an experienced adventurer and mountaineer. I know I keep saying this, but I cannot belabor this point enough. Who most likely knew how to handle some pretty dangerous situations. It feels like the police just wanted to stop searching and call it a day.
Yeah, I also think it might be just that in a state of confusion. Like, they're like, I don't really know of another possible explanation. Because I mean, if that were me investigating that scene, I don't know if I could come up with something as intricate You know, I mean, we all want to think that if we're in that situation investigating that crime, we might be like, oh no, I would have thought this or I would have thought this. But I mean, if that's the only evidence in front of you,
but there's no evidence.
Right.
There's no evidence. There's nothing.
But lack of evidence is also evidence in the sense of there's just not enough to go off of. So they're just coming up with the best that they do, in my opinion, because I don't think, I mean, how are you supposed to come up with anything other than to just wait for more answers? Like, hopefully Steven turns up or maybe you find his clothing or bags or something of some sort. But it is kind of annoying that they just stopped.
Or you just say, hey, we don't know.
Well,
we have no idea.
Right. You can say that, but that's not a great look. It's not a good look. Like, if we're being real, if a cop says, I don't know, then the public is like, what do you mean you don't know? Like, you're a cop. Figure it out. So, like, it's really a lose-lose situation. You're either going to be dead wrong or you're just going to look lazy and like you don't know what you're doing. I think it was just kind of a sticky situation. But I don't think they should have came to that conclusion immediately. I think they just should have, like, kept as long as possible, just been like, it's an ongoing investigation. Like, I wouldn't have given an answer.
Absolutely. So not only that, but Steven had gone cross-country skiing in that area before, so he easily could have already known the areas and places to avoid.
Yeah, absolutely. Which he was smart. He knew, like, what to do, so it wouldn't make total sense for him to be, like, just wandering off into the ice and just, like, dying, like, knowing that the ice wasn't strong enough and just, like, dying in the water.
Yeah. So, to further these points, he was a smart liberal kid studying at a conservative college. He knew how to forge his own path and still find success in doing so. He was passionate about the things that mattered to him and the people in his circle. He had a very successful long-distance relationship with a woman in another country and a happy family life. Nothing was amiss.
So I guess that checks off anything like running away or trying to start a new life or something of that sort, so...
The disappearance seems clean cut enough, other than the investigation, which is why we're not investigating that. It's what happens next that really has piqued our interest. It was May 5th, 1979, 15 months after Stephen had vanished, when the young man came to in a field in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Pittsfield is 700 miles east of Saugatuck.
Oh my God.
Obviously, Stephen was extremely confused.
Really long way, obviously. But like, that's a really long way.
Last thing he remembered, he was in Michigan with his gear, cross-country skiing. Now, there was no snow on the ground, the terrain was different, and it was strangely warm.
I don't even know. I don't know where to start with that. Like, how did he get that far away? Did he walk? Did he, like, end up hitchhiking? Like, how did he get there? Like, I'm so confused.
Well, he was too.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, that poor guy. Like, the amount of frustration and confusion that he must have experienced, I don't even know if that's fathomable.
Stephen wandered towards civilization until he was able to find a newspaper. Now he knew how much time had passed. Possibly the strangest part were the items that Stephen had on him, indicating that he had lived some sort of life while he was missing for those 15 months. He was wearing clothes that weren't his own. He didn't recognize them at all. On his person was a backpack with hitchhiking signs and maps. It was as if he traveled through Sacramento, San Francisco, Reno, Chicago, and Utah, which are even further away from Michigan than Pittsfield is. So,
yeah. I just wonder if he maybe hit his head and...
There were no injuries to indicate that that had happened. And if he had hit his head so hard that he got amnesia and wandered around for 15 months, he would have known. There would have been evidence on an x-ray, an MRI, CAT scan, whatever it might be.
And there was like missing persons, like photos of him, right?
I don't believe so, because everyone just believed that he drowned.
Oh, okay. Because I was wondering, was anyone looking for him? Because you wouldn't know if he was a missing man, obviously, but that part's interesting. I wonder if there were missing persons flyers or anything, if he was declared missing at that point. Because it was 15 months.
In all manners of speaking, he was legally dead.
Oh, that's true.
Stephen also had $40, new glasses, running shoes, and a shirt from a Wisconsin marathon. To further this mystery, his body was sore in ways that were indicative of him actually having run that marathon or walked a ridiculous distance. Stephen knew that he was only 20 miles from his aunt's house and made his way over there. Soon enough, he had reunited with his entire family, who had gone to sleep just two nights before, still mourning his loss.
God, that's actually insane. Like, the amount of just relief that probably that family most likely experienced when he just, like, walked through the door. Mourning someone's death and then they walk through that door, I can't even imagine that. And that's probably such a great experience, but at the same time, it's like, where have you been? Like, what have you been doing? Why do you have sores on your feet? Like, you ran a marathon. Like, why do you have a shirt from a different state? Like, where'd you go?
Stephen didn't just vanish from anywhere. He disappeared inside of the very notorious Michigan Triangle. What if I told you that there were other triangles around the world that are far more ominous than the infamous Bermuda one? Can you act surprised then?
Whoa. But actually, what is the Michigan Triangle?
Spanning across a large portion of Lake Michigan, the triangle has its points in Benton Harbor, Manitowoc, and Ludington. From UFO sightings to dimensional tears, the Michigan Triangle is a hotspot for anyone who is a fan of quantum physics. Well, the more unusual side of the study field. Strange occurrences in this area can easily be traced back to the 17th century. People have attributed the weird phenomena here to an energy vortex. Basically, this talks about how certain areas emit a sort of sacred and powerful energy. These are usually associated with positive things like manifestation, growth, and healing. But in some instances, an energy vortex can be very, very bad. A portal, also known as a ley line, is said to run down the center of Lake Michigan and is related to a Stonehenge found in 2007 underwater. Did you just breeze over this underwater Stonehenge?
Well, I mean, it's really cool, and I'm going to go back to that.
We'll also go back to the ley line, so...
Okay, fine. I'm just confused. I wonder if it just looks like an underwater graveyard, if that makes sense. Like, having all those big stones, that would freak me out. I'm one of those people that gets weirded out by large things underwater. I don't know what that's called.
Huh? The Great Lakes are terrifying. The Great Lakes are
terrifying. They're
scary.
There's a lot of boats in there, I think. Like, wrecked ships.
Spooky, spooky.
Yeah. A lot of shipwrecks.
They don't decompose.
It's freaky. Though, honestly, the water freaks me out. Like, I don't really swim in the ocean or swim in the lakes or anything. Like, I'll put my toes in, but, like, I'd rather have a pool with a view of the ocean. I don't really want to be in the ocean. It scares me.
Most of these disappearances we will be discussing are related to boats and planes crossing the lake, but it doesn't make their stories any less strange. But hold on a second. Before we go there, can we circle back to the Midwestern genie? Because I cannot get that image out of my head. Imagine the Michigan Triangle. You just go in. You're like, I'm going to manifest now. And then you're rich.
Oh, my God. It's like a genie of the Midwest.
The Midwest genie.
The Midwest genie is just the Michigan Triangle. And you're like, I wish with all my might. Well, hi there, little lady.
Oh, hi.
What you wish for?
I wish to be rich.
Oh, yeah, you did.
Yeah.
Did you think I was going to make that wish for you?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
No. Yeah, no. No. That's, I think you're thinking of the Hollywood genie. This is more of a Midwestern, like Michigan. You know where you're at, right? You're in Michigan.
Yeah. I'm in Saugatuck, Michigan.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can like teleport you to the nearest Circle K where we got nice washer machines down the road, and you can get a little nice
50 Cent soda pop, polar pop. But other than that, Sweet Pea, I don't know if I'm going to be able to help you. What would you say you wanted again? You wanted to be rich.
Can I have a husband too?
No. Well, I can get you a farmer.
Is he hot?
Beauty is in the, well, he's got a great personality and he's tall.
Can I have 87 hot dogs on a stick?
You sure can, Sweet Pea. That's what I'm talking about. All right. Oh, you come back next time and we'll see what else I can get for you. But you only get one free wish a week, okay? Yeah.
Leave a quarter in the snow.
Yeah, I'm not the tooth fairy. You're going to need to leave me a crisp, like $5 bill. Yep. I need to go to the Cracker Barrel down the road so I can get them no peppermints. Get some Andy's mints.
The Hollywood genies. Hey, girl, what you want today, girl? Oh, my God. Oh, the sky is, like, so blue today. Anyways, what did you want? Why'd you, like, bother me from my sleep?
I just wanted to know if I could have, like, a couple extra dollars for this, like, $27 acai bowl.
Are you willing to sleep with someone for it?
No.
Shit out of luck. Shit out of luck, girl.
Okay.
Shit out of luck.
Okay.
Anyways, what else can I do for you? We can go to the Beverly Hills Mall and you can pick out one thing. How does that sound?
One thing?
One thing.
Why? Can I have like two things?
No, you got one free wish. You think that this is the Michigan genie? No, you got one thing, sweetie. One thing.
Okay.
This ain't New York.
Okay. I didn't say anything.
I hear you want more. I hear you want more than one thing, girl. I'm going back into my bottle.
I don't want you anymore.
I don't want you here.
That one was really mean. Maybe that's what they talk about, idiotic side banter.
In 1679, the Le Griffon, a 45-ton barge, was the largest ship of its time on the Great Lakes. It set sail near the Cayuga Island along the Niajara River with 32 crew members. They went from Lake Erie to Lake Huron until the boat made it to Lake Michigan. They made a stop on an island to gather animal pelts from the local tribes. On September 18th, they headed back to Niagara. Once they entered the area known as Green Bay, the 40-foot ship and all of its 32 crew members vanished.
What?
Poof. Gone. Blipped out of existence.
I don't know how that's humanly possible.
Okay, so it was common back then for ships to sink or worse, but typically there is wreckage or remnants of a catastrophe.
Yeah.
To this day,
anything.
No one, and I mean no one, and they've tried very, very hard. This is a very famous disappearance, has located any clues as to where the ship and its crew could have gone.
That makes no sense. I mean, it must have wrecked. Like, it had to have wrecked and maybe capsized.
Where?
I don't know.
You know, there is not a lot of area for it to have gone.
What year was this? It's 1600s?
1679.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like we were able to go to the bottom of the bottom of the lakes and stuff or oceans at that point. So, I mean, we didn't really have the technology.
We can now.
That's true. We can.
It still hasn't been. We've found ships from that time in the Great Lakes.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I don't have an answer. Maybe it just never drowned at all and it didn't vanish and maybe they went to a different island. I don't know. I'm thinking of different things. I'm not sure.
Like sonars that you can cast down from planes and like see what's on the bottom of the lake. Nothing, dude. Nothing to fit that boat.
That's so interesting though. That's weird. I don't have anything for that really.
The concept of a ghost ship scares me for absolutely no reason. There's something just so eerie about that many people going missing on a body of water. An entire ship vanishing? Not so much. The Rosabelle was a schooner that was built with the intention of cargo shipment. In 1875, a ferry found the boat upside down. The 10-person crew had vanished. The ship was then turned upright and returned to the docks to continue service. Then, in 1921, her captain, Ed Johnson, had a premonition that something terrible would happen aboard the ship. He refused to leave on the Roosevelt and was replaced. A few days later, the boat was found capsized yet again with its stern missing. This typically indicates that there was a collision, but none were recorded. Some sources say that a storm turned her over, and others simply do not claim to know. What we do know for sure is that it was later detailed after an investigation that absolutely no collision had occurred, aka the mass collided with some invisible force. With all of this said and done, Roosevelt's crew was yet again missing. Flashing forward to 1937, we have another bizarre is an understatement, but bizarre disappearance. It was April 28th aboard the OS McFarland freighter during a blood moon. She was captained by an experienced sailor by the name of George Donner. He was well-versed with navigating frozen lakes and wasn't any stranger to the dangers they beheld. So moving through the waters in April, transporting coal from Pennsylvania to Wisconsin should have been an easy task. At 10:20 p.m., Captain Donner retired to his quarters and told his first and second mate to wake him up once they neared Port Washington. This would take around 3 hours. At exactly 1:20 a.m., April 29th, on Donner's birthday, the second mate went to wake him up. The door was locked from the inside. Much out of character, Donner did not answer to the knocks on his door. First mate Charlie Reicher joined the second mate in getting the master key to open it, afraid that something medically might have happened. The room was empty, though, with no sign of Captain Donner. They searched the entirety of the ship, but to no avail. Body recovery efforts were made, but those also proved to be fruitless. It seems as if Donner had just vanished into thin air with the door locked behind him.
Did he have I wonder if he had a window or a porthole that led...
Nope.
No?
Not that you can squeeze out of.
But I wonder if he maybe... I just don't know. I don't know enough. I don't know enough about him. Would he want to jump out? Would there be a reason for him to want to lock the door and, leave the ship?
He had a first and second, so obviously there was a chain of command if he were to leave. So he wouldn't be, abandoning... I mean, I feel like especially back then, it was super frowned upon to be a captain that abandoned your ship. So... I don't know. That's all I have is I don't know. I feel like I don't know enough.
So the room, you're like, it's not a big captain's chamber, huge. It's a really small room. When they went in, the bed had not appeared to be slept in. The porthole window was secured, but even if it was open, you couldn't have fit through it as a full-grown person, let alone a man. And the doors were locked from the inside, meaning you had to be behind the doors to lock them. And there was nowhere to hide in that room. No floorboards you could get in, nothing. That's what I was trying to say, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Then I have no idea. I have no clue.
Possibly the oddest part of the Michigan Triangle is the underwater Stonehenge that was discovered in 2007. Does this structure have anything to do with the odd disappearances?
I'm also shocked that it was founded in 2007.
2007, baby.
I know that's not super duper uber recent, but recent enough. If it starts with 2000, that's recent enough for me. Then that's crazy.
And it's said to be prehistoric as well.
Huh. I just wonder if it was now my brain's going crazy. I wonder if there wasn't a lake there at first. And so that Stonehenge was most likely something that used to be you could walk to it, you could walk through it, kind of like the one that we know of today. So it just makes you wonder.
There are cave paintings too down there. So
yeah, so it probably used to be habitable. And I don't know. It just makes me wonder, I wonder what those people were like back then. What were they drawing about? Why'd they build the Stonehenge? Was it...
They drew an elephant.
Aww.
Yeah.
That's cute.
Yeah.
But also crazy how that it's just underwater and that we have... Yeah. I mean, we just discovered a city. I forget where, but...
Or a mastodon. Sorry, they drew a mastodon.
Oh, mastodon.
It's prehistoric. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, still. But I don't know if it has anything to do with a mysterious disappearances. I think it's just history.
There are other oddities about this area that Stephen vanished, such as an event that the crew of a tugboat named Mary McLean witnessed in 1883. They reported that for 30 minutes, giant blocks of ice fell from the clear sky and damaged their ship. They actually kept a piece of the ice to show off what had actually happened. Much like in other triangles, people also see weird lights and what they report as UFOs. In 1919, a large group witnessed strangely large lights floating above the triangle, which turned into two balls of fire. When these fireballs crashed, it elicited such a big explosion that was later dubbed a meteor. It's also important to note the rate at which ships go down in the triangle portion of the lake, and there are yearly expeditions to find all of them, along with the various planes that have crashed into the waters and simply vanished. An official research team has concluded that approximately 1,500 wrecks live on the bottom of Lake Michigan.
Are they just in the spot of the triangle, or is it just in general?
A large majority of Lake Michigan is the triangle. But yes, supposedly a large majority of them are in the triangle area. While we only discussed a couple of the odd disappearances that gave the Michigan Triangle its name, it is important to note that there is a trend in the area where Stephen disappeared. But this isn't the only triangle in the United States that stirs up questions. Is it possible that these areas are somehow connected? What also fascinates me are the items that Stephen had on his person. Can these things provide clues as to where he went and what happened to him? Did he participate in the marathon in Wisconsin, or did he find the shirt somewhere? Or was it given to him? Placed on him, put on his body.
I mean, maybe.
Stephen's case isn't an isolated incident. While most of the other cases never led to the discovery of the missing or them discovering themselves, they are bizarre and follow a trend. Triangles are also a common trend when it comes to disturbing experiences. There are dozens of documented ones, but how many could there really be out there? How many are we not aware of? It could have been a coincidence that Stephen disappeared where he did, but something about it makes me wonder. There are way too many unanswered questions. To make any of this make sense, we need to deep dive into other triangles and areas that may be similar, even if they aren't classified as a triangle. To begin next episode, we will be researching similar leads in a haunting area of Vermont. It was the case of William Tedford that piqued my interest. He very literally disappeared off of a moving Greyhound bus. There's not much room to argue logic and science here. The theories run from a wide range of a serial killer, Bigfoot, and aliens, and even a rock that swallows people. But I think that there's something much more sinister going on. It seems as though there are modicums of evidence that these disappearances, because Tedford was not an isolated incident, can be traced back before America was settled by the Quakers and Puritans.
The Quakers.
Oh, the Quakers.
The Quakers.
Those goofy boys.
The Quakers and the Puritans. Wow. That's all. That's all I have to say. No comment.
That's it. That's all. No comment. No comment. We don't want to shame anyone or insult anyone, because the Puritans are very much still around. And
they are.
They're different than they were, so.
That is true. That is true.
But anyways, what are we going to find next episode? Stay tuned for next week. And don't forget, we release every episode Wednesday at midnight, 11:59 p.m. on Tuesday, sometimes earlier. So stay tuned.
And
ditch work,
listen.
Play hooky from school, listen to us. Fuck Prince Charming. Fuck him.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't like him.
Fuck him.
You don't need him.
We have a brand new bad review that we're going to read. Pamela, would you like to read it today?
Oh, sure. I would be honored. So we got one from a username called Little Birdie, and they said, I wanted to like this. Unfortunately, I just find that there is too much completely unnecessary cursing, even more so than LPOTL, which I don't know what that means. It feels like every other word in some instances is a swear. Don't get me wrong, I love a good curse word, but there's a place for them and it's not what I'm hearing. It just sounds like a 12-year-old who just learned the words. It makes everything come off as unprofessional and immature.
I'm 13.
really detracts, I think they meant distracts, from the stories and seems disrespectful to the victims. I just want to say first that if you don't
If you think we curse too much, then you think we curse too much. That's okay. You don't have to listen all the way through if it bothers you that much. Second, I think that your opinion of it being disrespectful to the victims is wrong because we don't do it at those times. And I think it's ludicrous that there is someone out there that's like, you're cursing in the same episode that you talk about victims. Because not once have we ever on this podcast, nor have we done it on any of our content on Instagram, have we talked about a victim's case and made fun of it, which some bigger podcasts and creators have done. Two, have disrespected the victims and survivors and families in any way by making it a joke or cursing in a way that is out of context or it just gross. Never have done that. So for you to like whip that out and be like, it's just disrespectful. We're not doing it in that way. So just like click off the podcast if you don't like it. Like, I don't know what else to say. Like, we don't do that.
The episode we actually cursed the most was Praveen Varghese.
Yeah.
And that was because we were astounded at the negligence. And his mother listened to that episode and sent us like a 5-minute heartfelt, tearful voice memo thanking us for telling his story correctly and in a, like, just shut up.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, be quiet maybe. Like, try that out a little bit. You know, but good luck. I hope you get well soon. And much love.
That's very Ellen Marshcore.
Much love, get well, and I hope that you tune in to our next episode, because it's going to be really good and it's going to be really interesting. And if you're not already subscribed to our Patreon, go ahead and do that, because at the end of every single episode, we like to have a little bit of fun, because we talk about a lot of dark stuff and we want to start having fun with you guys. That's completely separated from anything paranormal or true crime, because we all deserve to have a little lighthearted fun. So if you want to pop over there, we always do it after every episode. But until then, I think we're going to maybe close the case file.
Play Would You Rather.
We're going to play Would You Rather. So until then, we love you. And we'll see you soon.
Close the case file!